Here we are, and it's July 2022 already. And you know, for some reason, constant listeners, I've got a lot of babies being born in my world in circles. A lot of friends, a lot of extended family are going through some new births and new additions to the families. And congratulations to all of them as new parents and with a new birth. It's always great to see new families being created or families growing. I sort of watch that and, you know, being very well aware of what it's like raising kids, I just sort of smile when I'm offering my congratulations and thinking, just wait, it's going to get even more fun and challenging as the years go by. But there's nothing better than that. You can't make a better investment in life than something like raising a child. All right, so on with episode 58. And this dedication is an easy one this week. We're going with Jack Lambert. The great linebacker and Steeler. Ohio native, Kent State is where he played football up in Ohio. He was the poster child of a middle linebacker when you look at his attitude and his intensity. Maybe not his physique, since he was tall and skinny for his position. Sometimes, depending on the season, he would weigh in at just over 200 pounds. So he wasn't the biggest of middle linebackers, but he could play, and he was a perfect fit. Perfect fit for the Steelers and the Steel Curtain of the 1970s and early 80s. And really, Jack Lambert, he could be all that he could be because of that team. It sort of fit his mold and his style perfectly. And the players around him really turned him loose to be as aggressive as he wanted to be. Because you had Mean Joe Green and Dwight White and Ernie Holmes and L.C. Greenwood in front of him. That's not a bad foursome. You had a guy named Jack Ham alongside you. You had Mel Blunt and Donnie Schell, two Hall of Famers behind you. Yeah, with that array on defense, you could be as aggressive as you wanted to be, and Lambert was just that. I think he is the greatest cover in the history of Sports Illustrated ever. The cover, if you've seen it, it's just a picture of his mug in a helmet. He's got, you know, the no teeth glare, snarl, whatever you want to call it, showing at the camera. It's just a beautiful Sports Illustrated cover. Completely captures the character that is Jack Lambert. I've got a signed copy of that hanging in my house. And then you just think of the imagery of Jack Lambert, the different moments in his career, right? Cliff Harris in the Super Bowl down in Miami after the kicker for the Steelers, Roy Girella, missed a field goal, and Lambert getting into it with Cliff Harris. I remember a sideline fight or brawl that ensued in Cleveland when Lambert made a hit on the sidelines that some viewed as maybe late or dirty, and the bench is basically cleared at that point for a melee on the Cleveland sideline. I remember him, you know, standing there or sitting there on the sidelines with smelling salts near his nose, and then there's that iconic image of him always sitting on the sideline when the offense had the ball at Three Rivers Stadium, sitting on his helmet all by himself, just sort of that iconic shot of Jack Lambert. Again, really sort of memorable moments and images from a great period in NFL history when you look at the 1970s in particular. Jack Lambert was the NFL Defensive Rookie of the Year. He was the Defensive Player of the Year at one point, a four-time Super Bowl champion, of course, Hall of Famer, and the second-best linebacker on the Steelers teams of the 1970s. And the fact that I think that he's the second-best linebacker, that gives you a hint on what next week's dedication might be for episode 59. Now, what did him in at the end of his career in the sort of early mid-80s? Of all things, turf toe. So turf toe brought down the great Jack Lambert and basically incentivized him to hang it up at the end of his career. And by the way, who was one of Jack Lambert's teammates at Kent State when he was playing in college? A guy by the name of Nick Saban. Now, speaking of Jack Lambert, when you think of him, right, there is the statistics and how he actually played the game. And then there was sort of the image that he cast. And some of that has become embellished urban legend, so to speak, over time. And that issue of optics and image and urban legend, how things sometimes sort of develop a life of their own beyond the facts, got me to thinking about the first issue or dot to connect coming off of our dedication of 58 to Jack Lambert. And that is, of all things, something completely unrelated to football in the 1970s and Jack Lambert. It made me think of the Treaty of Versailles and what we were taught in school, right? The urban legend or the image of what the Treaty of Versailles did and what it meant and what it led to. And of course, the urban legend, what we've been taught to sort of assume as fact, was that the treaty was unfair, that it basically ruined Germany from the outset coming out of World War I, that it set the stage for Hitler, and that it caused ultimately World War II. And the biggest problem with the treaty, what were we told? It was the infamous reparations payments that Germany was forced to fork over to the Allied victors coming out of World War I. So reparations were sort of the root cause of all those things that came from the Treaty of Versailles, culminating in the onset of World War II. But upon further reflection and analysis, hogwash on the reparations excuse or root cause theory. I came across a book recently that I gave a read to, and it was from the great Ludwig von Mises, one of those great Austrian school of economists. Brilliant mind. He wrote a lot of great books, but his book that I read recently, it's titled Omnipotent Government. And von Mises wrote this as a study of Nazism and how to eradicate it. And he wrote this toward the end of World War II. So this was sort of written in the mid-40s. Brilliant book. If you get a chance to read Omnipotent Government, give it a read, because not only is it historical and interesting from that perspective, looking at Nazism and its roots, but again, a lot of the themes and theories, issues that he discusses, they are still unfortunately relevant today across a range of different economies and societies, including some of what we're seeing here within the United States. But von Mises points out that reparations did not bankrupt or starve Germany. If you break down Germany's income per capita and the reparations paid per capita from 1925 to 1930, when Nazism began to really rise, the data show income per capita grew over that time, and that although reparation payments also grew, they never accounted for more than about 2.6% of per capita income during the worst year, the peak year, so to speak. And in other years, it was lower, in some instances, much lower than 2.6% of per capita income. So reparation payments, they didn't make Germany poor. Better yet, von Mises pointed out that most of the payments were made by borrowing foreign money. And Germany stopped paying reparations in the early 1930s. So when you net out the balance of payments, German capital investment grew over the reparation payment period, not shrunk. It didn't shrink. And Germany didn't suffer from a lack of capital over the reparation payment period. And much of the payments made were funded by foreign capital flows. So foreigners ultimately ended up paying the reparations when you net it out. The key and best part of the treaty was really focused on demilitarizing Germany, right, to make sure that it wouldn't be able to wage war again. But when the Western powers allowed Germany to avoid those provisions, the die was cast on the inevitable move toward World War II. So once again, a great analysis by the great von Mises that shows that the Treaty of Versailles was not the debacle as originally designed that some historians or many historians have insisted that it was since the onset of World War II. Actually, the Treaty of Versailles could have worked, or maybe it would have worked, if stuck to, and the reparations did not, in the end, bankrupt or make Germany poor. Yeah, so I wanted to talk about the Treaty of Versailles briefly for three reasons, basically. One, I like history. I think sometimes you guys find some of these anecdotes that we share when we come across them is interesting, so I wanted to do that. Two, a lot of parallels with what von Mises was saying with respect to the Treaty of Versailles and how that impacted Europe and what's going on with Russia and Ukraine today, you know, whether it's the efficacy of sanctions or whether it's the West's hesitancy to offer up Ukraine substantive military aid. Very similar, it feels, to some of the underlying issues of what happened with Versailles and Germany and the Western powers. And then the third reason is it ties into our next topic, which is also falling in the geopolitical bucket. But it deals with something, of all things, it's an activity that I've never done in my life, which is golf. So I want to talk about golf and the PGA and Phil Mickelson and Saudi Arabia and the upstart LIV League that they created to rival the PGA. And I want to talk about hypocrisy, because the latter, hypocrisy, it's running like the bulls in Pamplona these days. So this all started back in March of this year, when Phil Mickelson made some comments, and it's not clear if they were on the record or if he was sort of quoted off the record, but he made some comments that got into the public space where he candidly said that the Saudis were scary because of their human rights issues. He didn't put it that diplomatically. He was much more blunt about it. But to play golf there, and to participate in this LIV effort, was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. And it's a very enriching one, I might add as well, because there's some significant money that the Saudis are investing in terms of prize money and purse with this this tour. Then when Mickelson said all those things, what happened? The virtue signaling started. So one thing that you saw were some of his sponsors, including the auditor, KPMG. They dropped him from sponsorship. Now, what's interesting about this is KPMG is an auditing global giant. It's got three offices in Saudi Arabia. So KPMG does business in Saudi Arabia, but they suddenly dropped sponsorship of a golfer who decided he wanted to do business in some way directly or indirectly with Saudi Arabia. You had a bunch of leadership politically in DC lashing out. But then now you've got our president, right, who's starting to beg Saudi Arabia for meetings and for an audience so that he can, what, buy their oil, while at the same time he's shunning our own domestic oil industry, I might add, which is interesting in its own right, but we've talked about that before. So don't get me started on all the virtue signalers who are out there attacking these golfers, right, when many of them do business with and invest in and placate not just places like Saudi Arabia, but places like China, which on a scale basis, at least, is way worse than what's going on in Saudi Arabia. So hello, NBA and private equity firms, if you're listening out there. And by the way, this LIV League, it's going to pose a serious threat, I believe, to the PGA. Too much money, too many big names to be committed into the future. And the format, if they're building this from the ground up, they're not, you know, on one hand, they don't have the advantage of tradition on their side, but on the other hand, they are not bound by tradition. So they can construct this from the ground up in the world that is 2022. And that can be more fan-friendly, more social media savvy, and more sort of, you know, viewing or TV friendly. And of course, as I said, they're signing up some big names that people are going to want to watch and see. It's going to be interesting to see if more players sign up and how the up-and-coming players decide which tour to join at the outset of their career. So the PGA, I think it's going to need to evolve quickly, or ultimately it may face an existential threat that is LIV. And competition is a you-know-what, especially when you enjoyed virtual monopoly status for so long like the PGA has. Now, as LIV and PGA are battling out for supremacy, and as I said, one of those key factors that decides who comes out on top might be money, let's talk about our next topic, which deals with the world of money and capital markets. And that is how the two major sectors of our economy that many investors and pundits always focus on, tech and energy, that's two huge topics, right, with something like CNBC every day, how they historically, I've always watched them and been interested in both historically. And what's interested me is how they move almost in opposite directions as a rule. So when tech is under a boom period, that typically means energy is in a decline period or a low period. When energy is booming, the opposite is true. Tech is struggling. And I think we might be in the middle of yet another inevitable shift or reversal that we're seeing in the economy today as we're exiting that sort of COVID era, which almost seems like a dream state, and we enter more of a reality-based period of our economy, albeit some scary realities when you're looking at geopolitics and inflation and supply chain and looking at the left assuming leadership in all things policy these days. But you're seeing some key underlying and sometimes hidden shifts occurring within our economy when you look at what's going on with tech and energy. And I want to start with employment, particularly the employment levels for those sectors within the S&P 500 companies. Now, since 2019, employment overall across the S&P is up. But during pandemic, healthcare and tech employment soared relative to things like manufacturing and domestic energy companies within the S&P. And I'm not sure if you realize this, but the domestic energy sector within the S&P employs one-third less people than it did in 2019. That was a shocking statistic for me, and I live in the energy space every day. Now, all that reduction in employment, it means it's going to take a long time for the industry to respond to higher prices because more activity, more drilling, et cetera, means more employment. And it takes time to hire, to train, and to have teams perform at a highly efficient level. And all that assumes the domestic energy industry can move its oil and its natural gas and so on through pipelines and other infrastructure that's being constantly constrained by the environmentalists and by DC policy. You're also seeing a shift in sector weightings in the S&P index. So for years, you might have heard how everyone was talking about how energy's weight within the S&P dropped to all-time lows. And it's true. It was down to only about 2% of the S&P index in 2020. Now it's ticking up again, currently sits just below 5%, I think 4.8% of the S&P, which, by the way, is still way below its historical peak of just over 16% of the S&P. So lots of room for energy to run within that S&P basket and its weighting within the basket. And then there's how energy as an investment sector performs relative to tech. And this, again, this is where historically I've always taken an interest in tracking these two because they do move in tandem, but in opposite directions. It's almost uncanny. Prior to the tech bubble in the 1990s, tech was just killing energy. Tech was clearly outperforming energy. Then the tech bubble burst, right? And commodity prices rose, and the energy sector was beating the heck out of the tech sector from 2000 to 2010 for that decade. Then things reversed again, and tech, when the era of the FANG stocks and low commodity prices came into being, it killed energy from 2010 to pandemic. Well, now it looks like with all the damage being done in the tech-heavy NASDAQ that you're seeing, which basically also coincides with tech sector damage being done to stock prices in the S&P, and with our energy policies creating energy scarcity, right, and high prices, energy is regaining lost ground and outperforming tech once again. I wonder what I was thinking about through the years, and I still wonder today, if one can time these cycles between these two sectors and make a killing at the right time by simply over and underweighting the two at the right time. If so, maybe it's time to overweight energy and short tech because nothing indicates these trends are root caused, that these trends basically, which are root caused and ill-advised policy, are going to end anytime soon. So you probably got some time and some running room where energy may continue to outperform relative to tech because really, you know, policy is one of the root causes or the root cause of much of this. And I don't see policy reversals coming down the pike anytime soon. So that's my civics editorial for this episode of The Far Middle. Now, speaking of policies, right, a lot of those policies that are killing regions like Pennsylvania when it comes to manufacturing and domestic energy and other pillars of the free market, they're often justified off of science, right? You see that all the time, which brings me to the next topic to discuss. Bjorn Lomborg, who is a great author and a great thinker, he writes extensively in places like the Wall Street Journal, has put out a lot of books on things like climate policy and climate science. He just creates a stellar body of work when it comes to these issues. He's made the point recently in a national publication that science gets hijacked all the time by opportunists, political opportunists, who want to promote certain policies in the arenas of climate and COVID and a host of other big issues. Now, the example, he used an illustration that I thought was very insightful. He used an example of 40,000 people who die every year in the United States in traffic deaths. So we lose 40,000 citizens a year because of traffic fatalities in the U.S. If politicians ask scientists to come up with a way to reduce traffic deaths to zero, the scientists would come up with a possible solution being a nationwide speed limit of 3 miles per hour. Now, with a national speed limit everywhere of 3 miles per hour, no one would ever die in traffic fatalities. But that is not science telling us that we need a 3 mile per hour national speed limit. Science told us if we want zero deaths, we should apply a 3 mile per hour national speed limit. Whether the 3 mile per hour speed limit does more harm than good, you know, whether it is a good trade-off, that's for all of us to decide in our political process. That's a different thing and not a science thing. Now you see the parallels to things like climate policies. Science doesn't say we need to stop warming and thus all these CO2 targets and energy policies, which can lead to ruin. Science says if you want such and such temperature on average globally, then you need this level of CO2 in the atmosphere. As to whether that makes sense, you know, whether the benefits outweigh the costs, that is a political question for all of us to weigh in on. Doing so is not science. Same issue with COVID and stopping the spread that we experienced the past couple of years. Science will tell you if you want so many infections or deaths per week or per capita, or if you want to achieve zero new cases of COVID, then here are the restrictions you need to place on commerce and travel and individual rights, etc. But whether we go that route or not, that is a political question that we all get to weigh in on, where we decide to weigh the pros and the cons of a certain path selected. it is not science. Yet everything you hear from bureaucrats and politicians and the left these days on climate policy and vaccination policies and pandemic management and on a host of other topics, it gets mislabeled as science. And then when you disagree with those prescriptive paths, you're labeled as boo hiss, anti-science. So again, a great point by the great Bjorn Lomborg. I wanted to share that with you. Now I want to talk about something here coming down the home stretch of episode 58 that I enjoy, but I know very little about. Now that could apply to a lot of things in my life, I suppose. I enjoy a lot of things, but I know not enough about really any of them when you get down to it. But particularly here, I want to talk about art. So I enjoy art galleries. I like it, you know, viewing art and walking through different galleries, but I don't know anything about it beyond the most basic of basics. Yeah, I know a Salvador Dali from a Picasso, and I can tell a Van Gogh when I see one, but that's about it. But I stumbled across a new concept where art is colliding with science. So along comes an idea with a cool name. The name is Mona Loves Gustav. A local friend of mine, Mara Pettengill, is a co-founder of this effort, and you have to check this website out if you enjoy art and you want to learn more about art as well as yourself. So the website, again, the name of the effort is Mona Loves Gustav. The website is MonaLovesGustav, all one word, .com. So you can Google that and check it out. Now, Mona Loves Gustav aims to define your art DNA. It's what they call your art DNA. In other words, what happens when you bring together your personality likes and your preferences with the art world? What types of art would you be attracted to, and to what particular artists? It's an ingenious approach to custom marketing for what is a very subjective product, works of art. So this site is a lot of fun. You take an online quiz, which is more of a series of four different works of art per page, where you select the one that attracts your eye the most. So you see a series of these four different pieces of art, and you click on the one, it goes to the next set of four, you pick the next one. And after going through the battery of selections, which is fun in and of itself, you're then presented via email with an art personality type. It defines what that art DNA personality type is and the type of art and artist best suited to you based on your selections. Then you can peruse works that fit your mold and even purchase works if you like to. So the art DNA personality types, they include different categories like the defiant contrarian, the rollicking idealist, the introspective thinker, and the alluring romantic, among others. And each type is defined at length for you. Now, I won't tell you which art DNA personality type I came back as, but I will tell you I was not tagged as the alluring romantic. Damn. Seriously, what is intriguing about this startup is how it combines art with data science. It's sort of, to me, STEM merging with non-STEM fields to provide something unique, something that's fun, and something that I think is very useful. As the site puts it, they harness the science of taste. I thought that was a pretty cool tagline, the science of taste. So check this site out. You'll have a lot of fun in a really short period of time. Have a family member or friend take it too and compare the results for both of you. It will generate, I think, a few good laughs and some discussion. And if you are an artist, go to their website to learn how to partner with them to get your works enjoyed by a wider audience. So Mona Loves Gustav. That's an example of leaders in the art world getting out there and doing and providing an innovative service for all of us to enjoy. Well done. All right, constant listeners, that's the way it is for episode 58. Follow me on Twitter at Nick Deolius. I'm on LinkedIn under Nick Deolius. Check out the website, nickdeolius.com. And order your copy of Precipice if you haven't done so already. Enjoy your 4th of July, which is coming up shortly. My safety message for you for the week is enjoy viewing and watching the fireworks. Try to avoid setting them off yourself. Till next week, stay safe.